I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
It's indestructible. It's indescribable. Nothing can stop it.
This town is in danger.
How can it be stopped? Mob hysteria sweeps one city. Before long, the nation and then the world could fall before the blood-curdling threat of the Blob.
Well, we aren't going to be talking about a killer piece of jelly from outer space on this edition of Parallax Views. But we are going to be talking about a blob of a different sort, namely the Washington, D.C. blob, otherwise known as the Bipartisan Foreign Policy Consensus, the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft is challenging that consensus, arguing that D.C. has taken too militaristic of an approach to U.S. foreign policy and makes the case that U.S. foreign policy should invest more in diplomacy and restraint rather than aggression and provocation. A member of the Institute, Kelly Vlahos, joins us on this edition of the show to discuss the importance of challenging the DC blob and how the US's current approach to foreign policy has not always been in the national interest. Of course, we also discuss the new President Joe Biden and what his foreign policy may end up looking like at this early stage in his presidency. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest that I've wanted to have on for some time now, Kelly Vlahos of the Quincy Institute. And also, do you still work at the American Conservative? You're the co-host of the podcast there, right?
I'm a co-host of the podcast, but I'm also a contributing editor. So I'm still writing for them, but I'm not working there on staff.
And the podcast is The Empire Has No Clothes, which is really worth listening to.
Yes, thank you so much. Appreciate that.
So, Kelly, if you could, for my listeners that may be unfamiliar, could you give a little bit of background into how you got into writing and journalism?
Sure. I mean, I started off as a standard newspaper person. I went into journalism to cover the news. So I came up through newspapers, which are sort of a dying breed now. But that's what I started doing when I got out of college, was just covering city beat, town beat, you know, Board of Education meetings. I mean, really the rudimentary, like, tools of the trade in terms of just getting out there as a straight news reporter. I found that I really enjoyed covering politics and had always had a personal interest in foreign policy and national security issues. Government, you know, I would say, getting into the stories in which our government has lied about foreign policy in the past, beginning with a real passion for writing about Vietnam and veterans, and the way that we treat our veterans when they come home. Agent Orange, PTSD. My generation saw the first Persian Gulf War, so I had friends who actually served in that war. And then as you know, people were getting sick when they came home, and it turns out there was this real vicious cocktail of pesticides and inoculations and toxic exposure that was leading to some real bad but very opaque symptoms in our veterans. And so I spent a number of years trying to cover that issue, and then that bled right into the next war in Iraq. So I've just been sort of, I really shifted from doing the straight news stuff and then coming down to Washington and doing more foreign policy, but more from a point of view, a more of a skeptical view of and a writing style that tried to uncover some of these policies and how they were affecting people, whether they be veterans or taxpayers or, you know, just you at home. And that's how I sort of went from doing the straight news stuff to more of the opinion driven, you know, war coverage and foreign policy coverage.
And then I guess the second part of that question is, for my listeners that are unfamiliar, what is the Quincy Institute? Because I think it's one of the best institutes we have out there right now when it comes to looking at foreign policy from a different perspective than maybe what's been called the DC blob.
Right. Well, I mean, I can tell you, you know, it's probably better that I tell you about how I came into it, because I've been at the American Conservative since 2007, you know, writing for them about the war. And it's a really interesting evolution, that magazine, because it does bring conservatives who are skeptical of our foreign policies and our foreign wars that didn't want to get into Iraq, who have been probably some of the loudest critics of the neoconservative and the blob wing of the establishment. That in itself is a sort of a rare bird in Washington to see conservatives speaking out against this. And so Trita Parsi, who is one of the founders of the Quincy Institute, had come to me a few years ago now and had asked, you know, I want to start this new organization, but I want it to be transpartisan. I don't want it to be, you know, another left leaning Democratic organization against war, nor a conservative one. I want it to be where both sides can come together and find common ground to literally change the policy in Washington from being a militaristic foreign policy to being one that's more diplomatically based, and to point out the flaws and the failures of the last 70 years of this militarized foreign policy, which saw the American hegemon grow and grow and our military footprint expand and our resources stretched in that process. And the 9/11 wars, as you know, have created a situation where we have been spread too thin. We can't get out of there. And meanwhile, we've ignored all of these issues domestically and that we've seen, you know, come to fruition in a really bad way in the last year. So he wanted to sort of exploit or at least harness all of that energy on both sides, which is kind of a real it's a new thing in Washington, and it's not easy. And so I went to work for him in September, less than a year after it launched, with the support, you know, of two major donor giants on each side, George Soros on the left and Charles Koch Institute on the right, and many donors in between. But having those two titans have the confidence that this thing could get off the ground has been a big thing. But, you know, that said, it's a lot of work because we are up against the blob. We are against a very entrenched, decades old machinery that not only includes the military industrial complex, but the intellectual complex of all the think tanks and donor organizations, academia, that have all been mobilized to maintain the status quo, which is military primacy as a matter of foreign policy and national security. And getting that, weaning them off of that, weaning the politicians off of that, is actually a huge challenge. And I'm excited because I think that there's an opening for this. I can feel it in my bones that I didn't feel it 10 years ago when I was covering the Iraq War. I can feel that there people want a change. And I think there's an opening with this administration, hopefully. But, you know, obviously there's some roadblocks there, too. But I feel that more people are on board now than ever before.
Yeah, I want to note when it comes to the Quincy Institute, I like how you mentioned that it's not necessarily purely left-wing or purely right-wing. This is about foreign policy. You have a lot of great voices there. Stephen Walt, I believe John Mersheimer, conservatives like Andrew Bacevich. But you also do have these left-wing voices. I believe Daniel Bessner. There's a researcher, Gunnar Olsen, who I know has done work there. Could you talk a little bit more about how there's not one flavor of politics at the Quincy Institute?
Right. Absolutely. Now, I'm an editor at the Responsible Statecraft, which is the online magazine of the Quincy Institute. So we are generating a ton of content every day coming in from outside contributors. Now, you mentioned a few, Andrew Bacevich, Stephen Walt, John Mersheimer. They're all literally affiliated with Quincy. But then we have all these other freelancers coming in from both the left and the right. And it is definitely a mix. I'm bringing in more conservatives. I'm bringing in more friends of mine from TAC and from the other conservative places that actually agree with us on ending these endless wars. That's a challenge, too, because there's a lot of trust building that is taking place now, because, you know, especially in this particularly fraught political moment where nobody trusts each other on the other side of the aisle. I mean, it is as bad as it's ever been. And so trying to bring people together and say, listen, we're here to talk about foreign policy and restraint. We're here to talk about how we get out of the Middle East, how we get out of Afghanistan, how we don't start another war with China or put more troops into Syria, making friends with Russia. These are all things that are not, they should not be partisan. They've become partisan. And so convincing more writers to come in, and we have writers who are former government officials, journalists, people who have been involved in peace action groups. We have people who have just been like conservatives who have been, you know, critics of the war policy for the last 20 years. So it's kind of an eclectic mix. I want to make it even more eclectic, to be honest with you, so that it doesn't sound like it's purely an academic exercise or just an activist exercise. But the consistency should be the restraint, getting out of the wars. But I'd like to bring in different voices. So if I can use your show right now as a pitch, if you don't mind. I mean, I have a lot of friends on both sides of the aisle, and I do know that there's a lot of common ground to exploit there.
Well, the reason I mentioned the left and the right being involved with Responsible Statecraft and the Quincy Institute is I come from the more left-wing side of things, although I initially started moving left in a weird way reading The American Conservative, because I found some of their commentary on things like libertarianism to maybe push me in a different direction. By which I mean The American Conservative has a lot of authors that maybe question libertarian orthodoxy, and that got me to think differently about libertarianism when I was younger and maybe question it a little bit more during my teenage years. And I think that The American Conservative had a lot of voices that came from both a libertarian and a non-libertarian sort of conservative viewpoint that, I should add, was much more intellectually based and principled than what you would find on maybe conservative talk radio. And I thought it was really good, but I don't hear as many voices on the left talking about foreign policy. Do you think that that's changing a little bit now?
I think there is. I mean, there's a very, I mean, just having been at the American Conservative for the last several years, I kind of fell out of touch with a sort of like progressive grassroots in Washington. And now that I'm at the Quincy Institute, I find that there's a real healthy, burgeoning like orbit of people on the left who are very much involved, like groups like Win Without War, for example, or just Foreign Policy. There's a bunch of groups who are involved in cutting the Pentagon budget and making our national security actually be about security and not so much about military force. So yeah, there are a lot of people, there are a lot of progressive groups that are mobilizing as we speak to really pressure the Biden administration to come through on some of his pledges, promises, whatever you call them, during the campaign, where he talked about getting out of Yemen, for example, and he seems to be going in that direction, you know, not starting any new wars, getting out of Afghanistan. That's going to be a whole other fight. So there are a lot of people on the left. It's just that in the past, and as you know, that once a Democrat gets into the White House, a lot of a lot of those anti-war voices get a little muted because their guy is in office. So what, you know, so his policies are somehow going to be more appropriate or more digestible than the Republican guy who gets there and wants to start wars. But I do think that there's a core of committed people with a conviction, and they're pretty well organized. So, I mean, that's heartening. And then, like you mentioned, that there are libertarian voices on the right, too, who have always been committed to staying out of these wars and ending Scott endless Horton. Wars and cutting the put it. Scott Horton is right there. He is unwavering. So I need to get more of those people over to responsible statecraft as well, because they do share. There's just so much that they share. It's just that when some of these other politics get involved, that's when this trust starts breaking down. And, you know, and believe me, I hate to be a conspiratorial, but isn't it convenient that every time we start getting together on this issue, whether it's war or, you know, economics, class, you know, there's always something to break us all up. And we're not supposed to be friends, but we should be. We should be working together and try to see that this common ground is going to actually get us somewhere, get us out of wars. I mean, this is serious stuff.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, we may not agree on everything, but I think different factions can have tactical alliances on specific issues, right, which is what we need more of. One thing I wanted to add was you said it's kind of hard to push back on maybe the entrenched mindset in D.C. What do you think is the cause of that entrenched mindset? And then we'll get more into Biden. But I feel like part of the problem is we still have a lot of, you know, leftover mentality from the Cold War in D.C.
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head there. I mean, obviously, when you've had decades of building up this sort of artifice of the military industrial complex, layer upon layer of programs, departments, agencies, budgets, everything that's been geared towards mobilizing for war. And in 1990, when the Soviet Union fell, there were a lot of people that are standing around going, okay, what does this mean for me? And I feel like when you have that much of a ecosystem built up over time, that they actually, they are going to fight tooth and nail to find a way to sustain themselves. And in many ways, that's how our wars, whether it be Bosnia, Kosovo, the Persian Gulf Wars, and 9/11 and the post 9/11 continuing operations overseas, that's where that all comes from. I mean, I feel like we are addicted to war. We are addicted to our military primacy. And it's not just the military that has sustained this. It is everything built up around it. And like I mentioned, you have this intellectual class of people and managers and administrators, politicians who owe their livelihoods, everything that they've subsisted for to this ecosystem. And so, I mean, and it perpetuates itself. So you see think tanks, you see academic programs,
even organizations, journalists,
absolutely. And it's really hard to break out of that and be the lone voice saying, well, maybe we don't need that program, or maybe we don't need that weapon system, or maybe it might not be a good idea to layer more sanctions on, or maybe it might not be a good idea to put more troops in Syria. And it's all wrapped around this narrative that the U.S. must lead, that the United States must persist in this hegemonic control over the world, because we're doing it for altruistic reasons. We're doing it to spread democracy or to uphold the liberal world order. And all of that sounds really good. And there's a whole canon of work and writing written about the liberal international order. And so you have kids that are coming out of school that this is how they're trained to think about foreign policy and national security. And they come to Washington and they find jobs, and those jobs are perpetuating this narrative. And so if you want to step out of that, if you want to resist that or to sort of be contrarian at all, you're risking a career, you're risking a reputation, you are risking status in Washington, and Washington is geared towards power and status. It's not money, even though that comes with it, but it's really power and status. And if you want to achieve that, you have to play the game. You have to talk the talk. I'm very heartened that there are more and more academics like, you know, my colleague Stephen Wertheim, who have come out, you know, basically saying this liberal international order was a farce to begin with. It was built up in World War II as a way for the United States to sort of control world policy by projecting military force, all couched in this nice language of upholding the liberal international order and internationalism. But it's really, it was a way for us to control things for the last 70 years. And people like him and others are coming out and saying, this wasn't such a great idea, because now it's falling apart and we've stretched ourselves too thin and we've wrecked, you know, many countries in the meantime. Look at Iraq as like a perfect example. So it's time to rethink that. And it's time to question the blob. And the blob's getting a little pissed off because they're starting to see people like Stephen and Andy and all these other people who are smart and respected starting to say, nah, I don't think so.
I wanted to add something there. I feel like it's become more fraught to take, I don't even like the word contrarian, but to take a contrarian stance against the foreign policy blob when it comes to these issues. You know, I feel like if someone like Gore Vidal was around today writing the stuff he was writing about when he was alive, he would be persona non grata. I feel like even, you know, 10 years ago, you could reasonably lobby criticisms at NATO, whereas now it seems like any discussion has been shut out.
Yeah, I mean, I might take a different view of that because I, you know, really started writing about these issues during the Iraq War, and I found the pressure to conform so much more intense back then. Like, people, like, you'd go to parties or you'd talk to people like at conferences or whatever. And it was like they were robots, like automatons, like spitting out the same BS about coin and counterinsurgency and we will win. We just must stay there longer. I mean, and like, if you even wrote about this or you tried to write about this, you were consigned to more marginal magazines or more niche magazines. Even the American Conservative is not considered a mainstream magazine, or antiwar.com. You know, so it's like, if I didn't have antiwar.com or TAC, I wouldn't have been able to write about this stuff. So I do see that it's getting a little easier for these points of view to come out. And I say that because I do see in academia where you do have people like Stephen or Patrick Porter or some of these guys writing books, getting in the New York Times and talking about ending endless wars. I mean, as much as like I would have liked to have seen journalists and people like us really getting out there 10 years ago, you know, it's true. Once the academia and the establishment class starts to embrace a particular point of view, that's a good sign, because in the past, they just shut all like contrarian views out, all alternative views out. And Andrew Bacevich, I give him the most credit out of all of them, because he was there in 2009, when everybody's lining up behind, you know, counterinsurgency and we just got to give it the college try in Afghanistan. He was just like, that's bull. And you guys are taking us down the primrose path. And because he was a veteran, because he was a college professor, respected in his field, he was untouchable and he was able to get stuff published and continue and not be consigned to the margins. So I agree, it's hard ultimately, but I think it might be getting a little better.
Yeah, I think there's some glimmers of hope. I think the Quincy Institute is one of those glimmers of hope. I also wanted to ask, since you mentioned things like the military-industrial complex, I feel like when I talk about these issues with people that maybe haven't delved as deeply into politics, I'm around a lot of undergrads since I'm right across from a university here where I live. I feel like when you mention it, things like the military-industrial complex, a lot of people their eyes will glaze over and they'll be like, oh, that sounds like a conspiracy theory. Or when you say something like, you know, maybe these wars aren't good. I've actually had people say to me, well, they don't affect me. What do I care? So how would you respond to those sort of responses, and maybe people that aren't as politically aware? How do you sort of educate them?
Well, I mean, I agree. It is difficult when you have a generation, for example, that grew up in an America where we were always at war, and they haven't seen any direct impact to their lives, unless they are one of those less than 0.5% of the population who have fought in our wars. And that's a problem because we have so few people in the military fighting our wars in this country. Most people don't know veterans or have any connection to their everyday plight when they come home. So it is sort of a challenge to connect. Why should you care? And all I would say is that we are spending $738 billion a year on the military and growing. And we have over 200,000 men and women stationed overseas, in which we have to have tens of thousands of people, contractors supporting them. We have billions of dollars in aid going overseas. And then you look in your neighborhood, you got potholes? Is your bridge crumbling down? Does your grandmother have adequate health insurance? Does your family have adequate health insurance? Do you have a living wage? You know, there are all of these issues here at home that every president, one after the other, has promised to take care of, whether it's Trump or Biden or Obama. Prison reform is another one. You know, the expanding income equality in this country has not been addressed yet. But somehow we have billions of dollars to send overseas to fight wars or rebuild countries or station troops for reasons that date back to the Second World War. I would say we need to bring some of those resources home. We have to stop creating reasons why we have to stay there. The more weapons we send, the more troops we send overseas in the Middle East, the more tensions, the proclivity of some of these Gulf states to start trouble with each other.
Blowback.
Iran. I mean, the blowback is that's enough. I mean, that to me, that's the biggest reason. I mean, we create terrorists. The blowback is one of the biggest reasons for me as to why we have to fight this fight to get out of endless wars, because we are creating terrorism. We are creating new terrorist groups. I mean, you look at ISIS. ISIS wasn't around before we went into Iraq, for example. But we create security crises that we then have to remain in a country or send more troops over there to fight. And this is the whack-a-mole, whatever you want to call it, the unending cycle of war. But convincing people that situation is draining resources from domestic concerns and domestic issues, and finding that connection and showing that the longer we're over there, the less you're going to get to fix your problems over here. And I think making it about U.S. interests, as selfish as that might sound, is a way to convince people that you have skin in this game. You are a taxpayer. You are a citizen. You are a mother or a daughter or a son. This matters to you just as much as it matters to politicians or veterans. And trying to make that connection, I believe, is very important.
And I was going to say, when it comes to the military-industrial complex issue that I raised, you know, I don't know why people have trouble grasping it. Ultimately, there's these weapons contractors that make money off these wars. I mean, it's as simple as that.
It is. And it's pretty frightening to see how that they have insinuated themselves in every state in this country. We're just having this conversation at Quincy about how we start reporting about this, because on one hand, we say, you know, we got to stop these defense contractors. They're getting hand over fist, billions of dollars to create these weapon systems. All the incentives are there to keep war going for these defense contractors. But what they've done is they've managed to spread their weapon systems production over a multitude of districts and states. So come election time, politicians will be like, well, I'm not going to be seen as cutting jobs. So I'm not going to advocate for getting this defense contractor out or this weapon system canceled or underfunding the F-35 because they actually bring jobs to my district or my state. And so they've been very clever and insinuating themselves throughout the United States. So what we have to talk about is how to repurpose all the money that's going into the military industrial complex to other industries. And there are things going on in different states where they're actually really fighting for this to repurpose a manufacturing base that has kept a community alive for other things, not defense, not killing machines. And that's going to be a tricky argument to make. And I believe we can make it, but it's going to take politicians with a lot of guts to work with communities who are willing to sort of overhaul their industrial base or their manufacturing away from the defense industry, or at least start to wean it off. You just can't cut it because you don't want to cut jobs. But we have plenty of studies that say that more jobs could be created in other industries in these communities that are not defense related, that this whole canard about, well, you're cutting defense, you're cutting American jobs is just that. It's a canard. And it just will take a lot of commitment and courage to finally do something about it. But like I said, they're very clever because there's billions and billions of dollars at stake in this defense industry. Come on. I mean, we know that most of their profits, most of their revenues go into CEO salaries and bonuses. The whole idea that they're just creating tens of thousands of jobs for America, it's a false claim. And I feel like that's where we got to go to, because that's the biggest argument that comes up for sustaining the military industrial complex are the jobs.
And I think there's massive possibility for new jobs and different kinds of jobs outside of the defense industry. I also wanted to get your take as we move into the question of Joe Biden and what his foreign policy will be going forward. What's your general take on the Trump legacy when it comes to foreign policy? Because I know a lot of people that will say, well, he didn't start any new wars. At the same time, I don't think he ended those wars either.
Right. The problem with Trump is that he talked a really good game and he got a lot of people on board with his campaign pledges to stop endless wars, get out of the Middle East, bring our troops home. And in one way, he was actually pretty good on some of that, like the idea or the proposal or his policy to get out of Syria, I found was very positive. The way he wanted to get out of Syria was not positive. He didn't really have a strategy for getting out. It seemed like it was some sort of like deal he had made on the phone with Turkey's Erdogan. His defense secretary quit, Jim Mattis, like a week later. It just didn't seem really well thought out. And he almost thought it was more transactional, having something to do with Erdogan, than it was about any long-term strategy of getting us out of these endless wars. But the impulse to get out was actually pretty commendable. The same with, with Afghanistan. It seemed like he really did try to bring troops home, but he was being sabotaged and thwarted every step of the way by the Pentagon and the entrenched military there that really believes that we should stay until the job is finished, which we don't know when that'll be. So I feel like he's had some good impulses, but on Iran, I mean, just, you know, killing Qasem Soleimani in Iraq at the turn of the 2020, I mean, he was almost like begging for a fight there, the rhetoric in China. I mean, so I just feel like it's such a mixed record.
The thing that really shocked me was when the Israel-UAE peace deal came about and, you know, Jared Kushner came out and said, well, this will make it easier for us to sell F-35 fighter jets to the UAE. And I thought, wow, that's just, you're admitting the military industrial complex is here with us.
Right. I know. I feel like all of like the conservative, intellectual, conservative restraint, realism folks, all of them in Washington really wanted to believe that Trump had some broader vision or goal about foreign policy. But in the end, I feel like it was so purely transactional. And that really showed itself in those Abraham Accords where, you know, sure, we're promoting peace by getting the UAE and Israel together in this normalization agreement. But then it turns out it was like an arms bonanza for the UAE getting all these goodies from us, including F-35s and drones and bombs. And Israel comes in and said, we don't want you guys to have F-35s because that'll hurt our qualitative military edge. And so they come to the Pentagon and bloviate. And then Secretary Esper turns around and says, okay, we'll give you even better stuff then. So everybody gets a bunch of stuff. The defense industry is head over heels. And then Kushner and Pompeo and Trump get to walk away saying, see, we brought peace to the Middle East. But they were really just making all of these deals. And a lot of it was just benefiting the military industrial complex and then creating all sorts of problems for the future. Like, you know, in Morocco, part of the deal was the United States acknowledging the Moroccan government over disputed territory and disputed for decades. And then we come in and say, okay, we will allow you to take over that territory and declare it, you know, official from our point of view, which, you know, basically says, okay, we're willing to throw the indigenous people in that territory under the bus as long as we get this freaking agreement right before Trump leaves office. And we don't care what if any wars start over it. We don't care what implications that might have on Israel and their treatment of the Palestinians. There was all sorts of transactional stuff going on that I don't think that it wasn't part of a broader plan. It really wasn't part of any sense of shifting foreign policy away from endless war. I just think it was just a patchwork of deals. And who did it benefit? Yeah, it benefits the Gulf states that want to keep getting stuff from us. Israel benefits because they're finding that they're building a sort of security club against Iran, which really I feel like was the real end game and all that was just like mobilizing the Gulf states with Israel against Iran. You know, so I feel like there's a lot of disappointment in the conservative intellectual, conservative anti-war community because they kind of felt like this guy had their back or at least was a vessel for all of their interests in getting out of these wars. And then he was just sort of he ended up being a sort of false prophet in that way.
What's interesting to me, too, about the forever wars, we're still in Afghanistan to this very day. And to me, I look at it and say, we almost gave figures like bin Laden exactly what they wanted because we're now embroiled in these endless wars, and it's a real drain on the state. I mean, all of this money is going into fighting wars. Meanwhile, back at home, everything's falling apart. It's almost right. Like we gave the terrorists exactly what they wanted.
Right. And the way I look at it is when you have a society when the military industrial complex has become so separate from the rest of society, like it's its own, I keep calling it an ecosystem because I feel like it could really, you know, aside, I mean, it needs our tax base, obviously. It needs us to keep generating our taxes. But other than that, they're so separate that it's just like a self-contained economy. And so I feel like they could easily just stay in Afghanistan forever. And it would be a sustaining, you know, process or whatever you want to call it, situation. If we could just only get those pesky Americans who don't want endless war out of our hair, we'd be fine. And I'm thinking that is not healthy for the state. It's not healthy to have a complete separate economy subsisting on war and this power projection overseas and maintaining a presence that is just sucking up billions of dollars from the other side, the other world. And this is no joke. It is billions of dollars. I heard that somewhere, I think somebody, and please don't, I mean, we would have to look it up, but I think it's like $10 billion just to keep our troops there. that's not even including all the aid and the training and the support and the contractor, all that stuff. I mean, that's a lot of money that could be going to healthcare, that could be going to jumpstarting this economy, which is in the toilet right now. And that doesn't seem to, it doesn't seem to compute for these guys over there in that other ecosystem.
So I guess this brings us around to the article that I wanted to have you on to talk about initially, and that is a piece you wrote for Responsible Statecraft. In major address, Biden says America is back, but what does that mean? Tell us about this address and what feeling you get concerning the Biden administration and maybe how it'll tackle foreign policy. It seems a bit ambiguous at this point.
I think it seems ambiguous because there are a lot of people, a lot of holdovers from the Obama administration who are responsible for us getting in into Yemen, into Syria, for continuing the war in Afghanistan in a big way. And so I feel like with those holdovers, they are mixed in with other people who have been better on these issues, at least better from our point of view. But I think there's some competing interests there. And the speech that he gave at the State Department, and he's given a couple remarks, so I can't remember. I wrote about the State Department remarks, I believe. I think it was ambiguous on purpose. I think he just used the moment as a pep talk for State Department employees. The morale in that agency has been like shit, for lack of better words, for the last like decade. It's not just Trump. I mean, that they've always had issues there. Then Trump comes in and they completely obliterated that agency. I think he recognizes that. I think he recognizes that there are a lot of people who are doing a lot of good work, who are dedicated to diplomacy over militarism. I think his first goal was to placate, not placate, but just, you know, assuage some of their fears about the future. But if we were expecting any real hard policy on China or Afghanistan or these other hot points on the globe, we weren't getting it. And I think that he's still formulating some of his policies. And I think there are some tensions there. In China, for example, I mean, there is a serious tension between the people in the blob and the military industrial complex, if you will, who want to see us build up our military assets in the region to confront China by showing military power and force and projection. And then there are those who are saying, no, this doesn't work. We need to use our diplomatic tools. We have to start helping our allies and beefing up their defenses so that they can protect their interests in the region. But we can't lead this. We can't continue to agitate there by sending more ships and more weapons and more submarines. So there is a tension there. And I'm hearing a lot of vocalization about being tough on China and China being our greatest competitor coming from Biden himself, from Secretary of State Antony Blinken, from the new Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. So I think people are going to be disappointed if they're expecting a real change in our China policy. And the same for some of these other areas like Russia, for example. Biden, you know, is boasting that he got on the phone with Putin and started tisking and tasking about Navalny and the protests. In Afghanistan, it does seem like the Afghan study group came out with this big report saying we can't keep to this May 1 deadline of getting our troops out that was agreed to by the U.S. and the Taliban under Trump because it's not a responsible way of leaving. So you're seeing a lot of this sort of mushy middle. And I think that speech, he didn't want to get into all those issues because I'm not so sure that he knows exactly, or I think they're not exactly settled on how they're going to approach some of these really critical foreign policy questions and conundrums.
So with yourself and also maybe the Quincy Institute in general, where would you like to see the Biden administration go in terms of foreign policy? Because for me, I look at it, and this is not an issue with, you're pro-Putin or you're pro-Beijing. For me, I just think diplomacy and talking and working out our conflicts bringing everyone to the table works much better than pounding our chests and aggressing each other the way the neocons did during the Iraq days.
Yeah, and I think you basically voiced everything of where we're at, essentially. Diplomacy over military force, military projection. And I mean, if you take each of the issues that, you know, or each of the regional challenges, whether it be China or Afghanistan or Russia, it's about taking a step back and taking a different pathway because the past hasn't worked. It's not as though we don't have decades of failures to build upon or at least to learn from. The example of Russia, NATO has been pushing and pushing with drills, exercises, and mobilization of NATO troops on the Russian border in their sphere of influence for years now. And, you know, unless you've really been paying attention, you wouldn't know that it's actually ramped up over the last couple of years. We have a writer, Ted Carpenter, who's been doing some good analysis in this area. But the domestic, you know, the domestic narrative here that we're getting is that the Russians have meddled in our elections. They tried to buy Trump. They've attacked us. They've launched cyber attacks against us. Everything is about their intrusion into our politics, into our interests, and threatening us. But we never talk about the expansion of NATO over the last 25 years, or these drills and the military pushing and pushing onto their borders, which has created a serious blowback from them that just doesn't seem to stop. And so what we're trying to say is cut that out. No more NATO expansion. We don't need it. Let's bring some of those troops back. We don't need to get out of NATO. We don't have to fire NATO. We need to talk about what Europe can do to bolster their own security in a way that's not agitating Russia, bring some of our resources home that we need here, and then talk, you know, what is wrong with opening up these domestic channels? Let's start by renewing this, you know, the nuclear treaties that are literally expiring right now. Let's talk about continuing to draw down the numbers of our nuclear weapons. Russia and the U.S. have the most nuclear weapons in the world. And for a spell there, they were coming down. But things kind of went haywire once we started using the Russians as this sort of scapegoat for all of our freaking problems here, you know? And so we're all about that. We're in, you know, and we can go down the line with Afghanistan and China, North Korea. For years, we've insisted that North Korea must denuclearize before we can talk to them. You know, before there'll be any peace, we lift any sanctions, they got to promise to do this, this, and this. It's not working. They're keeping their nuclear weapons for deterrence, just like we have our weapons for deterrence and the Russians do. And so to insist that they start getting rid of their nuclear capabilities until we let them raise sanctions, it's not happening. So let's engage in the talks. Trump actually was the first to actually open up some of those talks. Again, the follow through is left wanting. But I mean, talking and not making the denuclearization like the conditions for letting things go forward, that would be a different path. Quincy's all about that, too. Middle East, same thing. We should start extricating ourselves from the Middle East. We do not need tens of thousands of troops there and weaponry. Because like you said, it creates blowback and it makes us part of their security, you know, their security apparatus. And we are committed to problems that really don't involve us anymore. But yet the more weapons we send over there, the more troops and taking sides has created a situation where I don't know about you, but I don't feel like that we're any safer. If anything, I feel like we're more vulnerable. And Iran, same thing. Get back into the deal. It wasn't perfect, but by all measures, Iran was complying with the nuclear deal until the neocons got a hold of Trump and said, you got to get out of that deal. And now they're ramping up their enrichment, you know, and it's tense as ever. So that's what we're all about.
So before we close out, what does that mean to you when Biden says America is back? I think the full quote was... that America is back after, you know, 4 years of Trump and a feeling that global leadership, U.S. global leadership, has sort of been lost. What do you make of that statement, and what direction would you like to see him take things in?
I was kind of taken aback. Well, I wasn't taken aback, because most people would find a statement that America is back after 4 years of Trump as an encouraging way of saying that, wow, that was a real tough 4 years, but we're back on track and we're gonna earn back our leadership position. To me, as somebody who's been working in this space as a critic for 20 years, that gave me pause and made me a little anxious, because I feel like after everything that happens, that the establishment of which Biden comes from, you know, how many years, 40 years in Washington, it hasn't learned any of the lessons that going back to 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago means a world in which we are engaged in foreign military operations across the globe, hundreds of thousands of troops, drone operations in which we're dropping bombs on wedding parties and taking out entire families. The list goes on. You know, the environmental damage, the sort of like just breaking things and walking away. Is that what we're going back to? Because I don't want to go back to that. I actually want not to go back. I want to go to a place where we acknowledge that our foreign policy is broken, and we acknowledge that the way we have been doing things for the last, I say 70 years, but we could just take it back to 9/11, is not working for this country. And I would have liked to see him populate his administration with more people who felt that way. I think that is where our challenge lies, because people listen to that and they say, great, we'll get back to our global leadership and hang out with our friends and security agreements and alliances. But a lot of that stuff is part of the problem. And I don't want to go back there.
I was going to add to that. I think that, you know, a lot of people I've talked to, like Patrick Coburn, have talked about how we're sort of already living in a multipolar world. It's not going to be that the U.S. has this influence over everything, you know, and there are these regions of influence that Russia will have and that China will have. And I feel like regardless how someone feels about that, you know, regardless of whether they like that or not, it just seems like a fact of life at this point and a fact of geopolitics. And the sooner we recognize that, maybe the sooner we accept that reality, the sooner we can fix a lot of problems at home.
Right. And that's a really good point. It's a recognition. I think you and I recognize this. Many people recognize this. But we have to, you know, that recognition has to lead towards a real extrication of all of our assets and our resources and our people from the world. So we might recognize that it's a multipolar world, but that hasn't stopped us from, you know, having 200,000 plus soldiers and countless support staff and 170 countries at hundreds of bases. I mean, so yeah, it's almost like a denial is going on. And yes, the first step is recognizing you have a problem and then actually like acting upon it. And I feel like as long as there's a multi-billion dollar defense industry that thrives off of us maintaining the status quo, there's your first problem. Then you have a Congress that is influenced by that industry, and you have think tanks that are getting money from that industry and from the government to come up with reports and all sorts of justifications for staying overseas. You have to crack into that. And I feel like you hear people, these think tanks talk about, oh, it's not a multipolar world any longer. Oh, the liberal world order is breaking down. Let's take a look at these endless wars and military primacy. And they're talking the rhetoric because they see people like Stephen Wertheim and others are actually, you know, getting some attention. But let's see if those think tanks stop taking the defense contractor money. If they start really coming out with reports saying, let's get home, let's bring those troops home. That's when I'm going to start feeling like, okay, the blob gets it, and they're actually going to help us do something about it.
I want to end on a positive note here. So I guess I want to ask, do you think there is a chance that maybe people like us or the Quincy Institute can maybe affect a change in how DC or maybe even how the Biden administration deals with foreign policy.
Absolutely. So in addition to having all these great scholars and these and people like me, you know, preaching the gospel, we want to be an action tank instead of just a think tank. And so what we are doing is we're actually doing actual advocacy. So we have people going on the Hill. We have people talking to members of Congress and briefing them. We had a great conversation with Congressman Ro Khanna on Yemen, an online conversation. It was fantastic. So we're actually, we don't want to be just at the margins throwing bomblets and criticizing. We actually want to convince members of Congress that this is the way to go. This is actually the way that the people at home feel, taxpayers, military families. So we want to advocate for this change in Washington where it matters, because for too long, it's been the special interests like the lobbies and, you know, the defense lobby and the financial industry and all of these titans who have managed to keep the politicians voting their way. And we feel like, okay, now it's time that we get a voice. And I think that is the distinction from just being a magazine or a think tank that generates reports about how terrible war is. It's actually going to the people who can change the policy and changing their minds about it. And I'm really proud that that's what Quincy wants to do, because I've been kind of scribbling about this for years, but it would be really great to see an actual turnaround.
Well, I certainly think the Quincy Institute is doing some of the best work when it comes to trying to get people to think differently, especially in D.C., about our foreign policy. I really want to thank you for that and all the work you've done over the years, along with others like Scott Horton, Andrew Bacevich, everyone that is, you know, either involved directly or indirectly with the Quincy Institute. It's really important work. How can my listeners keep up with your work, Responsible Statecraft, and the Quincy Institute?
Sure. Well, my work is pretty much all at Responsible Statecraft, which is responsiblestatecraft.org. If you want to learn more about the Quincy Institute, it's quincyinst.org. Those are the best places. We're on Twitter at rstatecraft and at quincyinst. And I'm at Twitter at Kelly B. Blahos, and that's in Kelly with an EY. And also at Blahos at Quincy. So I have two competing accounts, which is kind of strange, but it works for me.
And if you could, can you plug the Empire Has No Clothes podcast?
Oh, yes, please. I would love to. Yeah, Empire Has No Clothes. We're at Stitcher and Apple. I usually go through Stitcher, and also at theamericanconservative.com. We post every episode there. Each week, we're a weekly podcast, and yeah, I mean, we're about a year old now, and I think we're doing pretty good.
And you guys mainly cover foreign policy, right?
Mainly cover foreign policy and lots of the stuff that you and I just talked about with Daniel Larrison, who's a regular writer at the American Conservative, and Matt Purple, who's a regular writer and editor at the American Conservative as well. So we have a good mix of different guests from the left and the right.
Well, thank you again, Kelly Blahos, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Kelly Blahos of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. I highly recommend keeping up with the Quincy Institute and their official online magazine, Responsible Statecraft. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Rats, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.